Thanks to Adrian Trevis for being our guest in the first half. We switch gears now. The next segment and subject sound like something right out of the X-Files, and it is, both literally and figuratively. Season 1, Episode 10, an episode titled Fallen Angels. It was about an alien spaceship that crashed on Earth. This dangerous creature gets loose. Government agents move in, surround the place. They act like sinister authoritarians, men in black. The creature was difficult to capture, I guess, because it had a cloaking ability of some sort, a kind of alien tech that made it all but invisible, sort of like the alien being the big game hunter in the Predator movie with Arnold Schwarzenegger. Is invisibility tech real? Might it explain some of the bizarre events we've heard about on Skinwalker Ranch, or the disappearances profiled in the Missing 411 books by David Politis? Is it a secret tech being developed and used by government agencies or government contractors? And if so, to what end? Is someone already using it to invade people's homes, to engage in mind control, to drive people crazy? Related to some of these bizarre incidents of so-called gang stalking, could be that all of these are tied together, along with UFO angles we haven't even mentioned. Robert Guffey wrote about this with his 2015 book, Chameleo, but he's just learned so much more since then, and he joins us next to connect the dots. Welcome back. I'm not sure how many of you are readers of Nexus magazine, but it's a pretty good magazine for alternative topics like we discuss on this program. The latest issue, the January-February issue, contains a whopper of an article by Robert Guffey. It's called Invisible Predators, Strange Creatures, and Secret Weapons and Shadow Biospheres, and it updates a lot of the ideas and themes that Robert wrote about in his 2015 book, Chameleo, which blew our collective minds when it came out and still lingers inside my noggin. Robert is a lecturer in the Department of English at Cal State University, Long Beach. He's a graduate of the famed Clarion Writers Workshop in Seattle, is the author of a collection of novellas entitled Spies and Saucers, his first book of nonfiction, Cryptoscatology, Conspiracy Theory as Art Form, was published in 2012, and I mentioned also his book, Chameleo, which came out in 2015. I've been dying to have you back, Robert. Glad to have you here.
Oh, well, thank you for having me on.
I know this is impossible to do, but if we could just return to Chameleo, the book that started your and my conversation back 6 years ago, 6-7 years ago, is there a way you can sort of put that in a digestible form, take as much time as you want, about the ideas that you developed there, how that story came to your attention?
You want the economy size, like
it's a, version, or yeah, it's, oh, you take whichever one you want, whatever it needs.
Okay. It is difficult to condense, but I'll try to do it. It was July 2003, and my friend Damien, who I've known, I met him on my 16th birthday. He was living in the Pacific Beach area of San Diego at the time. His apartment there was kind of a party house, people coming and going all the time. He happened to meet this guy named Lee, or Doyle, depending on who you talk to. He let this kid, and by kid I mean he was in his early 20s, he let him crash on his couch. And unbeknownst to Damien, Lee had gone AWOL from Camp Pendleton, the nearby Marine base. When he went AWOL, he took with him a 9mm Iraqi gun, over 24 pairs of high-tech night vision goggles, a DOD laptop computer, and an entire truck. Some of these items were in Damien's apartment. Some of them were not. Obviously, the truck was not in Damien's apartment. They're having a party one night. Lee opens up this laptop, and the DOD symbol appears on it. Immediately, Damien says, get that stuff and get the hell out of here. Lee says, no, don't worry. They can't track this stuff. Then in a very short period of time, there's a knock at the door. Damien opens it. There's a woman there who identifies herself as Special Agent Lita Johnson of the NCIS. That's not her name. And she says, I'd like to search your apartment. Damien's father was a narcotics cop, so he knew his rights. So he says, come back with a warrant. She says, I'll do that. Damien slams the door shut, turns to everyone at the party and says, go. They all throw their drugs and illicit substances onto his carpet and go out the back, smelling that there are cops in the area. Very soon after that, the San Diego Police Department and the NCIS show up. They have absolutely no interest in the copious amount of drugs littering the floor. They arrest Damien and they arrest Lee, take them both down to the San Diego jail, and they proceed to give Damien the Abu Ghraib treatment for an entire week. Now, Damien, since he grew up with this narcotics cop for a father, he didn't really like cops or law enforcement officers very much, and he was not a cooperative person in the first place. So even if he had known anything about what it was they wanted from him in terms of information, he probably would not have cooperated anyway. But he didn't. This is a very Kafkaesque scenario. They're grilling him, saying, what did you intend on doing with the stolen equipment? They thought that he and Lee were somehow in a conspiracy together to sell these items to some foreign terrorist agency, perhaps. Oddly enough, in this case, it was the government was engaging in the conspiracy theory. They insisted that Damien and this kid were in a conspiracy together to sell these items to Al-Qaeda or whatever. And Damien's saying, no, I have no idea what you're talking about. Finally, after a week, they let him go. Damien calls me. I had been trying to call him for a week. He wasn't there, which was quite unusual. He calls me. He tells me this weird story, and we both think, well, obviously that's the end of it. They wiser heads prevailed. They let him go. They realized he didn't know anything about this. Instead, a couple of days later, he calls me to tell me that he's being followed all around town by these jarhead-looking dudes, and not just by, like, one or two of them, like a whole parade of these guys following Damien into the 7-Eleven. He'd go in the Mexican restaurant down the street, and they would all follow him in and take booths around him and stare at him and make it known that they were following him. They weren't trying to be surreptitious in any way. Then he said that they were parking outside his apartment, shining halogen lights through his windows late at night, honking the horn. I've told the story on other occasions, and people tell me, wait a minute, I've had experience with law enforcement officers don't surveil people in that way. Just coincidentally, I was just watching a documentary called City of Angels, City of Death. It's all about the spate of serial killings in L.A. From the late 70s into the 80s. And they show surveillance camera footage of the cops watching one of the two Hillside Stranglers, and they go out of their way to show how they would purposely honk their horn at him to let him know that they were watching him. So it was exactly the same type of thing that Damien was describing. So he calls me to tell me all this, and it sounds kind of outlandish to me that they would use so much manpower to follow this one guy around, and I have to admit that I wondered if Damien wasn't suffering from some sort of meth-induced paranoia. Damien had been in and out of jail. He'd been a drug user. Ironically, this was actually one of the most stable parts of his life when this all happened, but I had to wonder what he was smoking. I tell him, well, if this is happening and these cars are following you around, they're parked outside of your house, why don't you take photos? Write down license plate numbers, send me some documentation. So he does that. It just so happens I have a friend up in Washington, Seattle, who works at the DMV. So I send him all these license plate numbers, all of which are in the book, and you can see. He runs all the license plates, and all of them come up as being officially non-existent. Which seemed odd to me. If Damien was suffering from paranoia, then obviously they would come up as people who lived in the neighborhood, people who lived in his apartment complex, just people who happened to live nearby. They wouldn't all come up as non-existent. So that made me think, well, wait a minute, maybe these are government vehicles. So at that point, I started to take him more seriously. Everything kind of amps up. All these people, he was getting bombarded with electronic harassment. This agent, Lita Johnson, all these cars would be surrounding the apartment. They'd be honking the horn, do all that stuff. Then suddenly Lita Johnson, the NCIS agent, would show up in her car. They would all pull back. All the people who were harassing and surveilling him would suddenly pull back. She would come in, come to the door, knock on the door, and she would say, oh, hey, have you changed your mind? Have you remembered anything? Can you give us anything useful now? And Damien would be like, no, because I never knew anything in the first place. I told you that. Oh, well, here's my card. If anything comes back to you, call this number. And then she would get back in her car and leave, and then all the perps would come back and honking the horn, shining the lights through the window, et cetera, et cetera. They start bombarding him with hallucinations, projections. He opened up the window, the curtains one day, and outside his window was a scene that had never been there before. It was a weird, surreal, alien landscape that looked like a Boris Vallejo painting with three moons in the sky. And when he opened the door, it just looked like the normal scenery. It was like the parking lot of the Vons next door. Close the door, look out the window, he's seeing this weird, surreal landscape. I should mention that at this time that his apartment was surrounded by corporations like SAIC, Science Applications International Corporation, and ATC, American Technology Corporation. These were corporations that specialized in non-lethal weaponry, acoustic bullets, things like this. Keep that in mind. He starts experiencing things where one night he's laying in bed, and they start projecting a silhouette of a hand with a gun in it, and it would tip down and point at his head and then tip up again. This black ball of amorphous energy crawled across the carpet, crawled into his leather jacket, which was lying on the carpet, and then the leather jacket crawled across the floor. His apartment started growing and shrinking. And he wasn't the only one who saw this. A couple of his friends came over and said, "Is your apartment growing?" The inside would look bigger than the outside, like Doctor Who's TARDIS. Or conversely, it would shrink. They would say, "Is the apartment shrinking?" And Damien, you know, at first thought that he was the one who was perceiving things strangely, but then other people would come over and see it too. Slowly, one by one, all the neighbors moved out. That was a weird thing. And then suddenly he calls me to tell me that there are people in this house that he cannot see. He's telling me that that there are people there who are in the apartment with him. He cannot see them. They're interacting with him. They're pushing him over. They're touching him. At one point, he was in the bathroom, and he was opening the medicine cabinet in the bathroom, and as he was opening it, as it was in motion, he suddenly saw one of these little people in this kind of like, he could see the shimmering outline of it, of a kind of like a skin-tight uniform, and that was, but only as the mirror was in motion. It was like a brief second that he saw it, and that made some kind of cockeyed sense to me. I mean, Damien's not an optical physicist or anything, nor is he a science fiction writer, but I thought, well, if it's light bending technology, maybe the mirror would affect it in some way. Occasionally he would see them as these like auras, these like little sparkling dots in the air. He sometimes, Damien suffered from migraines like when he was younger. And he said it almost looked like the auras you see in when you get a migraine. There was one day when I was on the phone with him, and suddenly I hear like pop, pop, pop. And all the tchotchkes up on his shelf just started shattering. And I could hear them. I could hear them exploding. And as I said, Damien's been in and out of jail. He was homeless in Washington, D.C. for a while. He's been around the block. This reduced him almost to tears. He got under the table with the phone, and he was like shivering like a scared little girl as all these objects just started shattering like something out of a Poltergeist movie. Sometimes all the ambient noise would just disappear. Like everything would just go silent. I experienced that when I was talking to him. You know, you get used to it. You're talking on the phone. You hear things in the background. You can hear the sound of the car is going by. Suddenly, you know, all the sound would stop, and then Damien would say, "Oh, it's happening again." And he called it like the cone of silence effect, like the old like Get Smart TV show.
Yeah.
Just all the sound, like disappearing, which doesn't sound like, well, big deal. That's not very torturous, but it can actually have this kind of weird Chinese water torture effect on you. At one point, he had this kind of, after several months, he had a weird waking dream. I tried to get a hold of him. He was gone, like, for 3 days. I couldn't get a hold of him. Finally, he calls me, and he and I say, where have you been? And he said, what do you mean? I've been right here. And I go, no, I've been calling you for 3 days. You weren't here. And he suddenly realized that 3 days were missing. And he'd had this weird waking dream where he was sitting on the couch in his living room. He got sleepy, but didn't go entirely asleep. And then these men came into the room and held his, he remembers holding his arms across his chest, like crossing them, as they peeled them apart and then injected him with something. And then the next thing he knew was like me calling him and saying, where the hell have you been? It was around this time that, you know, things start to get serious. It's already serious, but I said, you know what, give me the number of the NCIS agent, because I said, you said she gave you her card. Can you give me your phone number? I just wanted to verify that this woman, you know, existed outside of, you know, in objective reality.
Yeah, right.
Not in Damien's subjective reality. I was pretty certain that all this was indeed occurring the way Damien was describing it to me, but I just wanted to make sure. And so I call her on the phone, and she picks up the phone. She identifies herself. Hi, I'm, you know, Special Agent Lita Johnson. And I say, listen, I got this friend, Damien. And she was immediately standoffish, or she seemed affronted that I would be calling her and asking her these questions. How dare I? And every time I asked her a question, she wouldn't give me a straight answer. It was a very, like, CYA kind of, I would say, you know, my friend says that you're following him. And then she says, oh, well, no one in my agency is currently following your friend. In that kind of, like, very precise, you know, like I'm talking to a lawyer.
Yeah.
And everything I asked, that was the response. She acted like he was crazy, but then I said, okay, so is it okay if he leaves town? Because I naively thought if he left town, then maybe the harassment would stop. Is it okay if he leaves town? And then she says, and she acknowledged that, you know, he had been arrested and that he, for a week, she acknowledged all that. And she said, well, no, it would be better, I would advise that he not leave town. And I said, why? Because she had told me he was no longer of any interest to them.
I tell you, hold on, Robert, we need to take a break. This is great. I'm glad you're recapping this story. There's a lot still to cover. We're talking with Robert Guffey, who's doing a brilliant encapsulation of his book, Camellio. This is a rabbit hole he started digging into years ago, and he's still digging into it. The story, the basic story we've just heard is that a friend of his played host to an AWOL Marine. The Marine may or may not have stolen some technology and files that put his friend under surveillance by unknown operatives who seemed to have at their disposal invisibility technology, some kind of cloaking device. And although this friend of Robert's was not always a reliable witness for much of his life, the more Robert dug, the more he found validation for what he was being told, including finding the scientist who invented this technology. We're going to get into that part of the story next on Coast to Coast. So, Robert, you're sharing the story about your friend Dion, who gets into this predicament, starts telling you this wild tale about being under surveillance. There's invisibility technology, short people in inside his apartment. And although he's not been a reliable witness his whole life, you start believing him because as you check into it, things start making sense, right?
Absolutely. And I guess I should point out, I changed all the names of the book. So in the book, I call him Dion.
Right.
His real name is Damien, but he said he didn't mind if I used his name. So I was talking to Lita Johnson, the NCIS agent, and I asked her, is it okay if he leaves town? And she said, well, no, I wouldn't advise that. And I said, why? And she said, well, it might make things difficult later on, which was just, it was, I was being given paradoxical information. On one hand, he's crazy. We have no interest in him. We're not following him. On the other hand, he can't leave town because it might make things difficult. So the conversation didn't go well. The whole transcript of that conversation is in the book, by the way. So afterwards, you know, after the missing time, the waking dream, and then this conversation with Lita, Damien's down at the beach, and he runs into this beachcomber who's selling his van, this black van, for like $500. And I told Damien, just buy that thing and just get out, just pack what you have in the van, just get out of town. Again, naively thinking the harassment would end if he left town. Damien was about to do this, and then the money he had got stolen out of his wallet. And along with identification and all this other stuff, out of his house, after we had discussed him buying this van and leaving town. So now at this point, now we're in like January of 2004, and he's constantly urinating blood. He's got a metallic taste in his mouth, which is an indication of electromagnetic poisoning. He's losing weight. So I elected to send him $500. I send it via Western Union. I didn't even ask. I didn't tell him I was doing this. And I call him, and I said, hey, I go, the money's waiting for you. You need to go pick it up. And I say, if you've ever sent anything via Western Union, you have to give the person a password so that no one else can come pick it up. So I said, let me give you the password. He goes, no, wait, don't give it to me now. Let me get all my stuff together, then give it to me, because he didn't want me to say it over the phone, and then someone, whoever's listening, goes and intercepts the money. I go, okay. So a couple of hours later, he calls back. He says, give me the password. I'm about to give him the password. The phone dies, just cuts off. I thought, that's weird. Call him back. I'm about to give him the password. Phone dies. That happens like half a dozen times in a row. And I'm getting extremely frustrated. And then I remembered something about when you make a collect phone call, there's a brief moment when the operator says, will you accept the charges? In that moment, you can both hear each other. So I made a collect call, and as the operator is saying to Damien, will you accept the charges, I yelled out a hint as to what the password was, which was pornographic in nature, so I can't say it over the air, but you can read it in the book. So I heard him laugh because I for a half a second, and then it went dead. But I understood from his laughter that he understood the hint. And so he went to the Western Union. He picked up the money. He buys the van. He throws all the stuff in the van. Leaves a note on the door that says, I've gone west, which is into the ocean. By the way, he tells his landlord, yeah, I'm leaving. He said the landlord looked so relieved. Like everyone had moved out. All these new people had moved in. Damien was the only person who was still there from 6 months earlier. And the landlord looked like he was as stressed out as Damien. The landlord was like, thank God. Damien gets in the van. He drives. He drives away. And then, keep in mind, again, January 2004, drones are like not a thing. Drones are not flying around the sky. It's like science fiction at this point. He calls me after having gone like 2 hours out of town and tells me that there are these little like circular, he called them like mini flying saucers, following him around, following the van. And that this was a constant thing. And he drives out into Texas, finally decides to drive to Minnesota. And at some point, either just before Minnesota or just after Minnesota, he stops off at his bathroom, and he's washing his hands. And a guy, this middle-aged man, comes in, is washing his hands in the sink, and he turns to Damien, and he goes, if you just give them back, this would all end. And he doesn't say it in like a threatening way. It's more like a pleading tone. Like, please, it's like he's tired. Like, please, can you just give it back so I can stop watching you? I mean, this guy looks like a nervous wreck. He looks like the landlord. Damien's stunned. And then a half a second later, another guy comes in and grabs the first guy by the collar and just drags him out of the bathroom. It was like he had broken script. You know, I mean, the whole point of the targeting is to make is to gaslight the person and make them think he's going crazy. So you're not supposed to break script and admit that you're actually watching him. This was the second time someone had broken script. The first time Lita Johnson had done it. That's an episode I skipped over, but that involves the food fight he had with the feds. That's in the book. But Lita had also at one point kind of slipped and gone off script and said something that was an admission that they were following him and he wasn't crazy. He leaves the bathroom and he keeps driving, and at one point on his way to Winona, Kansas, his van breaks down on the side of the road, and these two good old boys pick him up. And I get a phone, like at 10:30 at night, I get a phone call. I pick it up, and it's this guy with like a thick Southern accent, and he goes, "Professor Guffey?" And I go, "Yeah." He goes, you know Damien?" And my first reaction is like, "Okay, what? My God, what's happening now?" And the guy goes, he says that Damien had broken down on the side of the road. They picked him up and brought them back to their house. And he goes, "This guy's saying that there's these little like flying saucers following around. There's like invisible little people. Is that true?" And I go, "Actually, yes, that is absolutely true." And I tell him an encapsulated version of everything I've just told you. And as I'm talking to him, there's two guys that brought Damien back. The other guy in the background goes, "Hey, you know, Jeb or whatever the hell his name was, get over here." They go over to the window while I'm talking to the guy on the phone, and they open the window, and outside is one of these little circular drones. And now the two guys are like flipping out. And I ask them, I go, "Can you put Damien on the phone?" And they put Damien on the phone, and he says, "Yeah, these guys just like kidnapped me. I think they think that like I'm being followed by demons or something," or he was scared they were going to like exorcise him. they thought that like he was possessed by demons or something. As I'm talking to him, he's right next to the bookshelf, and he tells me he sees a copy of Behold the Pale Horse and Protocols of the Elders of Zion, like on their bookshelf. So that was kind of like their headspace. So I say, "Put him back on the phone." So now they're convinced that everything I've said and that Damien has said is true. So I convinced them to put gas in his van and fix it and send him on their way and not exorcise him. And so he gets back in the van and he drives. He ends up in Winona, Kansas, which is a tiny, tiny town. It's got like 200 people living in it. And for some reason, when he gets there, the harassment ends. Who knows why? I don't know if it was because it was such a small town that, you know, if a parade of jarheads are following this black van through town, like you'd notice it. Or it could be that everyone in Winona owns a gun, and these invisibility suits, they don't make you bulletproof. So that's a possibility as well. He gets a job, and he settles down for about 3 months. He's able to relax for a little bit, and he goes online, and he's looking for any information about this invisibility technology. And he sees an article about Professor Tashi's invisibility cloak in Japan. That doesn't right. look like what he saw. Stumbles across this website, Camellio.net, and finds that this is a website by a guy named Richard Schoenger. And Damien calls me and says, "You should look at this website. Based on the description, it kind of looks like what I saw. You should look at it." So I go there. As I'm looking at it, I'm reading the About section about Schoenger, and it says that he's a 33rd degree Scottish Rite Freemason at the Scottish Rite in Long Beach, California. This astounds me because I'm a 32nd degree Scottish Rite Freemason at that same lodge in Long Beach. And I think I must have met this guy. And the website says that he's a scientist, an inventor, an engineer who's worked in the military and the private defense industry for decades. I think this is just way too weird. I must have met this guy. I email him and I say, "Hey, I'm Robert Guffey. I'm a writer. I've interviewed people like Stephen Heller, the Bishop of the Gnostic Church in Los Angeles and many other people for various magazines. And I'd like to interview you about your this Project Camellio technology that you're writing about. And he writes me back and he goes, oh, Stephen Heller, I know him. You know, and I mentioned that I'm in his lodge. And he says, oh, you're in my lodge. Well, sure, you can interview me. Why don't you meet me at the lodge this Saturday morning? And after the rituals, we'll go somewhere and you can interview me. So I said, oh, okay, fine. So I contact Damien and I say, yeah, he wants to be interviewed. And Damien says, I'm going to come down. I want to be there when you talk to this guy. Damien was having some dispute with his landlord, and right before he left, he took a bunch of wet cement and poured it down all the faucets in the sinks and the bathtub. Then he takes off, gets back in his van, comes to Southern California, to Long Beach, where I was living, and we meet up, and I go Saturday morning to the lodge, the Scottish Rite, and I meet Richard, and when I meet him, I suddenly realized that I have met him before. I had seen him performing the rituals, and he has a very distinctive voice and distinctive mannerisms, but we'd never been formally introduced. So after the rituals, me and Damien take him to George's Greek Cafe in Long Beach. We have lunch, and then I took him to my office on campus, and I was thinking there's no way the probability that anything that we learned from this guy would tie in to Damien's experiences were probably extremely low. I wasn't expecting too much from it. But before we even say anything about Damien's story, Richard just starts spouting all the stuff that ties in exactly with everything that Damien has experienced. He just volunteers that, oh, well, with this technology, you know, you could make soldiers invisible on the battlefield, but also you could use it as a psychological warfare. You could use it to make a foreign dictator think he's seeing bizarre alien landscapes. You can make him think that a tree is an elephant or vice versa. You can make a room look like it's larger on the inside than it is on the outside, or conversely, you can make it look smaller. He says that he had met with SAIC, the corporation I mentioned earlier, and he had met with the Navy 10 years earlier to try to sell this idea. He and his partner, Dr. Lev Berger, an eminent respected physicist, they had given lectures at Spa War. They had, and the Navy had come out to see Dr. Lev Berger's laboratory in Hemet, which is in the middle of nowhere. SAIC had come out, and representatives of both would seem to be interested. And then they would vacuum up all this information, and then they would disappear. And Richard says, you know, I really think that the technology was stolen from me, and I've already hired a lawyer, and I'm doing FOIA requests, and I'm planning on suing because I think that they're using the technology without my permission. The interview went on for, you know, about 2 hours, and then finally, I'm looking at Damien, you know, sideways, watching him get more and more pale, and I had told him beforehand, don't interrupt, you know, don't, no matter what Richard says, don't interrupt. So by the end of it, I turn to Damien, I say, tell your story to Richard, and at first Richard looked like on guard, as if we were about to sandbag him or something. And Damien starts telling a story, and at first Richard looks a little skeptical. But then when Damien gets to the part about talking about moving the mirror and seeing the person behind him in the mirror, he seemed a little more engaged at that moment. And then when Damien mentioned that sometimes he would see them as these little auras, Richard kind of like, he leaned forward. He goes, that's exactly what it looks like when the technology is not working correctly. And at that moment, I could tell Richard was totally engaged, completely. He believed everything Damien was saying from that point forward, because he knew Damien was not an optical physicist. He knew he wasn't a science fiction writer and could not have made up that detail. Damien, we ended the conversation. Damien, I thought that Damien would be relieved that this had confirmed that he wasn't crazy. But I got the sense that actually he had been holding on to hope that maybe he was crazy.
Because the alternative was worse, you know.
Absolutely, because at least you could take medicine. You're fine. Now you're fine, and everything can go on as it was. But if you're not crazy, that there's so many implications there that it's not something your mind could easily recover from, and Damien kind of spiraled down after that. And I lost touch with him for about 2 years.
Hold on, Robert. We're going to take a break here again. We're talking with Robert Guffey. He's just shared with us part of the story that's told in his book, Chameleo. I cannot recommend it highly enough. It's such a complicated and interesting tale. But so much has happened since that book has come out. That's what he updated in this Nexus article. We're going to get into that, what's happened since. Right after this, zombies take us into the break. She's not there.